Chapter 14. It was a bad dream, of course, a dream so vivid that Bex almost felt the pain and smelled the sweat on the bodies. Considering her fatigue in the early hours, it was strange that she had eventually fallen into such a deep sleep. There was no warning. After tossing and turning for what seemed like hours, she suddenly slid into oblivion. As she slept, she dreamed this nightmare that seemed all too real. First she dialed the hotel in Glasgow, and this time Charlie picked up. He even seemed pleased to hear her voice. "Been worried about you, sweetheart," he said. And that was as far as it went, before she thought she was going to die. The door to her room opened, and she did not even have time to cry out before they came fast, noiselessly, into her room. Like robots, they were on her, immobilizing her before she could fight back. So her instinct told her she was about to die. In that time, she also realized the attack was from Tessa Murray and the man from the Villa Mirta. The man was probably Alchemist, she thought, and if it was indeed him, then she would surely die. In the vivid dream, at one moment she was quietly talking to Charles on the telephone, then the two shadows were there, not a sound. They appeared to glide over the parquet floor, unstoppable, terrifying. His forearms held her down, one tight over her throat, the other low, hard across her thighs, just above the knees. He was a powerful man, and all her strength was sapped in a matter of seconds. A smaller, softer hand went to her face, rolling out thick duct tape, pressed and stuck hard and gummy over her mouth. Then another length was peeled down over her eyes. She grunted and tried to move her facial muscles, but even this taxed her strength and spirit. Her mouth and eyes stung as though nettles had been flicked into her face. Then came the sharp prick of a needle in her forearm, followed by thick darkness. Of course, it being a nightmare, she came round and knew exactly where she was, in the Villa Mirta. She could not have explained how she knew this, but she thought it might have had something to do with the smell. Pleasant, a tincture of June roses overlaid with lavender. The room was somehow familiar. A plain, stripped pine table stood under the window, and the room obviously caught the sun all through the morning. Two pictures were on the wall. One was a reproduction Turner, the other a good try at Constable. She even wondered if Alchemist needed to be reminded of the beauties of his motherland. So, Beck sniffed the scent and felt the sun through the window, and she heard voices and knew that they were seeping in under the French doors that led from the living room at the roadside of the villa. Her first thought was, well, good. I shall have time to compose myself. She knew there was no chance of living. Rarely had she been frightened of death, for it was a fact of life. She simply thought, bugger it. I fancied living with old Charles for a bit longer. Fancied seeing him through, looking after him, having years of companionship. Her mouth was dry as a desert road, her head pounded, eyes smarted under the tape, while her lips felt cracked and sore, twisted by the pressure. They had secured her hands, and when she tried to move she felt metal biting at her wrists. Shackles of some kind. Handcuffs, maybe. Bex still thought she was going to die, heard the click of a coffee cup on a saucer, and longed for something to drink. Almost smelled the toast. Her hearing so acute now that she clearly detected the sound of teeth taking a bite. So her own mouth mirrored the intake of breath to catch the crumbs flaking from the bite, and savoured orange marmalade, and the charcoal taste of bread almost burned, because that was how she liked it, well done. The pain in her muscles was intense. She knew cramps would finally overcome her calves and bring horrifying hurt to her body. She concentrated through the soup of agony, the fog of thumping head, and the drifting clouds of distress, centering her mind toward the voices in the next room. As she had resigned herself to inevitable death, the voices surprised her and eventually gave her a way out of the horror. "Ah," said Tessa Murray through the doors. "Ah, there's the bell. I wonder who this can be." And the bell was huge, its tone lasting, filling her head and coming through the walls and window from Brissago's church. Bex woke in a lather of sweat, surprised that she was in bed at the hotel. Outside, the sky was that shade of blue that spoke not of warmth, but of the illusion of warmth that comes on a cloudless day in winter, a morning edged with frost, and the smoke from chimneys rising straight. Her watch said that it was 8:45. Her hands flew to her face, and she was relieved to find herself without restraint, and with no tape on her lips and eyes. The dream had been so strong that she thought she could feel the trace of the tape gum burning her tongue, and its stickiness on her skin. She remembered telephoning Scotland, and she quickly sought out the notepad on the night table. Deciphering her scrawl, she dialed with the international code, and from Glasgow's Central Hotel she learned, "Mr. Gauntlet left this morning, madam, gone off to the Isle of Ringmarocchi, where the monks live in that monastery of theirs, by the way." "Ringmarocchi," she said softly, aloud, thinking it all sounded romantic. "Ringmarocchi," again, as though testing it, wanting so much to be there with Charles, yearning for him. Didn't know what the word yearning meant until now. If London said she could leave today, then she might head up to Scotland. They might even get to complete their honeymoon north of the border. She felt the unmistakable palpitation low down at the crux of her thighs in anticipation. Then she felt a twinge of guilt. At her age, she shouldn't feel like this. It was the way her generation had been brought up to think. She showered, soaping her body, lingering over it, and wishing Charlie were there to wash her back. The nightmare remained with her, a strong memory, leaving an unpleasant depression in its wake. For a moment she wondered if her dream was something psychic, a portent of things to come. This she dismissed almost in the same moment as she considered it. Bex was a thoroughly practical lady, and did not really hold with matters psychic. Yet the scent of doom remained. She seemed to be shrouded in unease, a most terrible sense of dread enveloping her, as though an evil poison flowed and mixed with her blood. She dressed in jeans, a thick silk shirt in pearl grey, and her now favourite Belfast-bought wasted dark jacket. With her face on, Bex was finally ready to go down to breakfast. Yet even that was an effort. She missed Charles fearfully, wondered when she would hear from London, thought about her new husband on this unknown Scottish island once more, and again wished she were there. Never in her life had she missed somebody else so dreadfully, not even when she'd first gone off to boarding school at the age of 10. The dining room double doors were of wood and glass, ornate and fussy. Inside, it was warm, heated with reckless disregard for the ecology, by a large wood-burning pot-bellied stove. The padrone, whom she'd seen in this same room over dinner last night, came toward her, greeted her in English, led her to a table halfway down the room, asking how she felt, if she'd slept well, and told her that it was dry but cold outside, as if she hadn't already worked that out for herself. A scattering of guests were planted around the big polished room. A silent couple in their late 40s faced each other without speaking. The third year of marriage is usually the breaking point, not the seventh, but this couple looked as though they were on lap 21, and their faces told a sad story, as old as time and cold as freezing fog. Three men, identifiable the world over as commercial gents, nursed sick headaches from last night's booze, terrified of what the day might not bring. One lady sat apart, lonely, schoolmarmish, angular, heavy-breasted, with restless, empty eyes. Another woman, younger, fair, plump, and 40, with a cheery smile for everyone, almost a come-hither twinkle, was also alone at the far side of the room, munching away on fresh rolls, spread thick with butter and preserves. Her body language said she would not be alone for long, or she would die in the attempt. A family, noisy at a window table, looked like something from a French comedy movie. Father seedy, mother dowdy, children arguing strident, and funny uncle, a droll with constantly shrugging shoulders. Into this walked Bex, poised, elegant, trying hard not to be noticed, knowing suddenly that for some unaccountable reason she'd become more visible in this small, pleasant hotel dining room. It was as though the fact of her recent marriage had been leaked to every person in the room, and each one was smiling, eyeing her with lascivious intent.